morning. We're here at the Disaster Podcast, and Norm Rucker and I are having such a good time. We've been talking for the last half an hour and forgot we were supposed to go on the air. So welcome to the Disaster Podcast. Thank you, Physio Control, for the use of this booth and allowing us to do this. And certainly my sponsors, Paragon Medical Education, who are so busy they can't be with us right now. But we got some amazing guests here, and Norm, you can't see this, unfortunately, but he's wearing a very nice kilt. And just for a quickie, why don't you explain how the whole kilt thing got started? Because my friends started this thing, and I totally agree on what they're doing with it.
Well, September is Men's Cancer Awareness Month, primarily prostate cancer, something that the blood test, the PSA test, only gets right about 40% of the time. And the only true way to actually be checked and find out you're healthy or not is to get that prostate exam. And so from that, Kilted to Cure Cancer came up, because if you're tough enough to wear a kilt, especially in this audience, you're tough enough to get the prostate exam. So it became a consciousness-raising awareness. Myself, I joined in on it because I'm a bladder cancer survivor. Not prostate, but in the fire service, we're exposed to all these toxics, especially after we've knocked the fire down, we're in the salvage and overhaul phase, and you dump that 45-pound SCBA. But everything in the room, which is primarily petrochemical based, such as this table, these chairs, the carpeting, et cetera, is still off-gassing, and we're breathing those in. And that's why my home department, San Francisco, our female firefighters have the highest rate of breast cancer, more than six times the rate of the general public. Firefighters have 2 to 5 times the rate of the general public in bladder cancer, which is primarily a smoker's disease. And we could go on with prostate, with brain cancer, etc. So this is just to support that awareness, and the fact that my wife is also an Outlander fan doesn't hurt.
Now she likes the kilt. She wasn't so sure at first.
Yep.
Well, Norm, tell us a little bit about what your career has been like. And he calls himself retired, but he's certainly not, and we'll get into that in a minute.
I'm a failure at retirement. I had the good fortune to get in on EMS. 1973, I took the second pilot EMT class they ran in the state of Connecticut. The television series Emergency had been on one season, and I was 17 years old, and a first aider and the medical sergeant on my Civil Air Patrol ground search and rescue team, and it was a good fit. I had no idea it was going to end up being a life career. I did my paramedic training 78, 79 outside of Detroit. When the whole training program was just 480 hours, 240 classroom, 232 clinical, 8 ride along, go save lives. And now the field internship alone is longer than what my entire training program was. The advantage is that it taught us to be curious, to go, okay, what's going on? And so it was constant learning and more learning and watching things come back around to where they were 10 years ago, only we have a greater depth of knowledge of how things and why the fat at that time didn't work. And just CPR. Now we're at hands-only CPR. Mm-hmm. When we were doing it, we had to do the stair step with the 4 breaths and have the perfect rhythm strip to even be eligible to do advanced cardiac life support. We had the 3-person CPR. So you had someone breathing, you had someone compressing, and you had the intra-abdominal. So you had this action coordinated going on.
Yes.
Between belly and chest. We did the toilet plunger CPR study in San Francisco. We've done the auto pulse, et cetera. And what's come back around with this study in science over the years and the decades, and we're getting it right. And it's the hands-only CPR and the early defib, and our save rate is what we dreamed of when I first started. 1 in 3, if we can get to them in time, 1 in 3 are living not just a field save. I got them to the hospital alive. Something happened. That's your problem. We did our job. They're walking out of the hospital to resume their life. That's a true save.
Neurologically intact. And I've been in here exactly the same amount of time you have. I started in 79, took training in 78. So we've seen so many changes. And that's one of the cool things about this conference, is just all of these people that have seen so much, and we're here to witness the changes that are going on right now to make it better. But you were the fire guy. Now, again, what I really want to focus on in this podcast, because it is a disaster podcast, we did an audio podcast a while ago, but it was so quick and we didn't get to cover much, so I wanted to have Norm back so you could see him.
Okay.
But talk about the wildfires and what you do and what you've been doing for, it seems like he couldn't ever get away, because as soon as he'd quit one assignment, they'd pull him into another one. Okay. And as you know, all of Northern California is on fire, as it has been for some time.
All right, well, backing up a little, my wife Vicki and I, both paramedics, worked for the city of San Francisco for 20 years. She had to retire due to injuries. I retired to take a chief's job in Ouray, Colorado in 2005. But while I was with San Francisco, I had the opportunity for special operations medicine, disaster medicine, because I taught structural collapse rescue, and we were doing a drill, and one of the students got sick, and everyone looked at me, and I realized, oh, that's right. I'm also a paramedic. I'm supposed to take care of these people after we rescue them. It's only a drill or a body recovery until you get to the patient. Then yes, this other stuff has to be done. So I started learning about crush syndrome, and from there, taking care of my teams, because if my team is at 100% health, our chance of successful rescue goes way down. And I was surf rescue swimmer, a SWAT medic, rope rescue, pretty much a poster child for adult attention deficit disorder. I ended up in Ouray, Colorado, because the top rope rescue school in North America, Rigging for Rescue, was there. And I took a course in 2003, and I said, hey, if this chief's job opens up, give me a call. Not actually expecting them to call, but they did the following year. I had my 20 in. So I did 5 years, go from America's 14th largest city to super rural, urban frontier medicine, where we didn't have nursing homes. My closest hospital was level 4 hospital in the next county north of us. And so the average call went from 20 minutes to more like 3.5 hours. And if it was, wow, in the backcountry, 14 hours to 20 hours. So not only were you having to resupply medications, I'm having to make sure that the mountain rescue team is adequately fed, adequately hydrated, so that they can help carry and portage things out as we're continuing to do the care. When I stepped down from that in 2010 and retired, and we're blessed, civil service, we have good pension, and both my wife and I have our health insurance through our pension, so we could afford to stay retired. But I just wasn't ready to say, that's it, I'm done. So I started doing the wildland fires and some contract work. So I got to be a boat medic at the mouth of Mississippi for a month for the BP oil spill. I had the opportunity to go to Saudi Arabia for 3 months on a short contract to teach structural firefighting. But most of what I've been doing is going out on wildfires as either a line paramedic or as an information officer.
So what for those that are not clear on this, because I think it's an interesting role, what is the role of a line paramedic on a fire?
Okay. In the morning, we get up, get our assignments, and then we run sick call at the medical unit, taking care of the firefighters, the little nickel dime stuff. So you get real good at blisters, you get real good at taking care of all those little fun things, poison ivy, camp crud, reminding folks it's a good idea to wash your hands after everything and before you eat. Then I would go out to my division that I'd be assigned to, and I'd provide on-site medical coverage during the day for whatever it is we were dealing with, and keeping my firefighters as healthy as possible. And most of the issues I deal with out there were heat and dehydration related.
No doubt.
Especially among the newer firefighters who are trying to establish that they can hold their own, and the female firefighters, because they were having the double pressure put on, especially their first season or two, that they're not the weak link. And so they would shoulder on, stand tall, and just push until they couldn't.
I know that one.
And so that was mostly wellness care, and every now and again something would happen, and then it was earn my pay time.
So what kind of illnesses and injuries did you see commonly? Heat, of course, and dehydration.
The heat and dehydration is primarily, and if I couldn't get them well enough to hike out on their own with 2 liters of IV fluid, we'd have to portage them out or fly them out. Coordinating running that. I deal occasionally with vehicle accident, because the roads, when we're that far out, aren't always that good. And if you're driving through smoke and stuff, sometimes vehicles don't see each other, or you accidentally drift off the road, or you're distracted. such as the time we were in a convoy and a air tanker did not follow the lead plane quite right, and we got an entire load of retardant dropped on us, and before the wipers could clean the pink sludge off. And you haven't lived till you've been slimed.
So was there some danger in that, in inhaling it or getting it on your skin? Or?
No, the danger was we couldn't see, and before you could stop, bumped into the vehicle in front, and one person was not wearing their seatbelt, so kissed the dash, and I was dealing with some nosebleed issues. So.
Well, I imagine safety is, I guess it's everybody's job, as they say, safety is everybody's job. So I imagine that was a primary part of your job as well. Even the issue of dehydration and heat is a safety issue, because your job is to keep them going, keep them on the line, keep them healthy, so they can do their job.
And absolutely. So not only did I answer to my division supervisor, but I worked very closely with the safety officer assigned to the division. So if we spotted trends, hey, this is what I'm dealing with, this is what's going on. Safety was in on the loop. So in ICS, medical falls under logistics, but we're also answering very directly to the safety officer, because it's keeping everything working as closely as possible. This is what I'm seeing. This is what we're going with. On one fire in Texas, safety came up to me and said, they have some mountain lion traps out. Really? I didn't have that in paramedic school. What exactly is a mountain lion trap?
Good point, yes.
Well, it shoots a cyanide darts. And I'm like, we're all picturing like, you know, some South American movie where, with the blowgun.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it turns out it's not that way. The mountain lion eats the dart is shot into its mouth from the trap, but everyone's coming up to me in panic. Doc, do you have a cyanide antidote kit? Just tell me you have that. I said, let's research this a little bit. And safety and I got together, and we were able to determine, because fire did not want to buy, because we had 12 divisions, 12 Lilly cyanide kits at 600 something bucks a pop for this problem that turned out
the potential of
was not as potential as it was going to be. But so you get caught. This season we've had, with the intensity of the fires, we've had a number of firefighters in California and up in Washington burned over.
Yes, unfortunately.
And so we're seeing many more actual burn injuries than we typically would see in a fire season. And also because the ground is so dry, we see a lot more snags or widowmakers. These are dead trees from previous fires that are still standing. They haven't fallen over yet.
Wow.
And the wind can affect them, or there's been a little burning at the roots, or no burning at all. The understory is burned out, so now you don't have the grasses and shrubs, roots holding the ground steady.
Good point.
And so one of the injuries on the California fires was rollout. A burnt log rolled down the hill and pinned a hot shot, and they were doing night operations. And
they couldn't see it.
Couldn't see it. They heard the noise, and by the time they saw it, he was pinned underneath. His crew was able to get him out, but he still ended up with 27% second degree burns.
Ooh.
And it's not like you could just be the ambulance maitre d' like in the urban environment. When I was a SWAT medic, I was in working the zone, and once we got things safer, I got out, I could turn medic up,
right, yeah.
Bring up the crew, do the handoff, and my part was done. You're doing extended care, sometimes for hours, till you can get them out or get things in to take care, but you don't have an entire ambulance worth of gear. It's just what you're carrying.
Right.
So it has its challenges.
Wow. And it's a good thing you probably lived and worked in the rural environment, because it kind of sets you up for that understanding of having to be with somebody for an extended period of time with potentially a serious injury. And I'm sure that medic school didn't teach you about leopard mountain lion bites and that kind of thing either. I mean, how much danger is there? I guess it depends on where you are. But
well, yes, it depends
critters
on where you are.
Critters are certainly a concern.
A concern. We had that firefighter in Idaho 3 weeks ago bitten by a bear.
Bear?
Yeah, a hotshot crew out in a remote area. And so they just threw the tarps down, ground covers, and were sleeping on top. And bear came in and bit one of the firefighters. And that's highly unusual.
Bears bit you. I thought they swatted you or something. This one did.
This one did. And they were able to catch it and through DNA proved that was the bear and put it down.
Okay, so how do you treat a bear bite?
Like any other animal bite, you get control of the bleeding, you cleanse the site, you transport them in, and they test for rabies and make sure they're up on their tetanus status, etc.
Oh, so what other adventures have you seen? I mean, how many different fires have you worked since you started this extended campaign?
This season, I've been on 6 different fires. I've been out 12 weeks. You take an assignment, you commit for 14 days plus travel on either end, and sometimes the fire gets knocked down quicker and you go home, or in the case of like we've had this season, it's like, oh, you're done here and you still have 8 days available? We're gonna send you over here. Sure, no problem.
So I'm sure there's people listening to this that are going, gee, he's retired, he's not working with a specific team or a specific agency, how do I get to do that?
Okay. You have your valid, they have wildland fire EMT, EMT intermediate, and paramedic. So you have valid license.
Mm-hmm.
Either your agency sponsors you to go out through the state as a cooperator,
right,
or you affiliate with your local Bureau of Land Management or Forest Service if they do the AD program, which is as needed, basically. And if they take you in, you're federalized. To be fire line qualified, you have to have the S-130-190 basic firefighter 2 class, 5-day course, and you have to pass the arduous pack test. And it's walking 3 miles, carrying a 45-pound pack in 45 minutes or less. And where I am at 8,000 feet, they give us a 45-second altitude time bonus to compensate for there being less molecules of oxygen per lung full of air. And I'm acutely aware of that because I'd only been chief 2 months and I had to go up near the top of our 14er on a rescue. And by the time I was at 12.5, I knew there was oxygen in the air, but I was having a tough time finding it.
You couldn't find it.
So once you have those, then you're registered in the system. They expect you to show up with all the gear. The problem is you're moving from state to state. And my USAR counterparts and my SWAT medic counterparts run into the exact same issues. I'm Colorado paramedic, and yes, I have a national registry. That doesn't mean I can just go into another state and practice. Also, in a remote environment, you're a paramedic. Don't you have morphine? Don't you have fentanyl? Don't you have Dilaudid? Are you carrying ketamine? Or we'd really like you to have Versed so that our guys, if they're injured, won't remember how life truly sucked.
Bit them.
Yeah.
Literally.
And no, I can't carry the narcotics. Now, California, being as large a state as it is, within the state, they use state paramedics, primarily fire department paramedics, and they are expected to show up non-restockable. So they have to show up with a minimum of 60 milligrams of morphine so that they push some, they're still able to go. They don't go to the local hospital and say, okay, I pushed 20, I need 20
back. Well,
that's
the thing. You can't just go to Rite Aid and pick up morphine.
The department that sends them out, that's part of the cooperator agreement.
Oh, okay.
They charge an extra fee for the ALS equipment and restock of any medications that are used. And so that's working within one state. There's not a medical director in the National Wildland Coordinating Group to handle all the different medics. So I will show up in Idaho, they'll take my credentials and I'll get temporarily licensed for the duration of the assignment as a paramedic. And on the Idaho side, I can do all sorts of stuff except 12 lead EKGs. But if I'm on the Montana side of the same fire,
wow,
I get a Montana credential and I can do 12 lead EKGs. But I'm here to tell you, I personally do not own a Zoll or a Physio LifePak 12, LifePak 15, to do that. It's like, oh yeah, that's nice to know.
Well, and you know, you bring up something, because even within the state of California, because I worked a state disaster medical assistance team as well,
right,
as a federal, and that's one thing when we went, in 2007, when we went down to San Diego County and surrounding area for the fires, there were EMS agencies going, well, wait a minute, you're not accredited in our county. Well, gee, there wasn't time to do that.
Yeah.
You know, there didn't seem to be, basically the medical director at the time said, okay, you're all working under state scope because I said so. Well, not everybody was happy with that, but it is a problem, especially now when you're thinking of going from state to state, much less just county to county within one state. So it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, on the advanced life support level, I carry an airway kit. I carry 2 liters of normal saline, and the which that's 4 pounds in weight. When you're having to add up what you're carrying out there, and I'm about to turn 60, and I'm trying to keep up with teenagers and 20-year-olds that are really fit, and it doesn't always work well. So medications I carry, the important ones. I carry Epi 1 to 1,000, I carry Benadryl, and I carry Zofran. Because whether we're packing them out by ground or by air, I don't want them chumming. And
good
so
point.
We'll
yeah.
push the Zofran. And those, all three of those, I can get restocked out of local systems, which is what I've done. Mm-hmm. And then beyond that, I'm drawing off what the other units have brought out with them. Sometimes you'll get a fire agency, oh yeah, we're paramedic, we got a full ALS kit in the door of our truck. Great, something happens, I may be borrowing your medic and your gear.
That's good to know. Yeah, it's good to know where those resources are.
And that's part of my job in the division, is I get assigned to a division. After we have our assignment breakout, before they break, I turn, I said, okay, how many EMTs, how many first responders, what gear, what equipment do you have? So it's not just what I have, it's what I have available to me in the division to make it work.
Well, unfortunately, we're running short on time. Certainly, he's so fascinating, I could sit here and talk to him for hours, but we've talked to other people, too.
True.
You're
another
a hoot,
time.
Norm. I just enjoy talking to you so much. So is there any place they can go to learn more about what you do, or is there, you have a website, or you want social media?
On social media, there's the Wildland Firefighters Group. You can also look at the state academies. Colorado, we run 2 Wildland Fire Academies a year. Arizona Wildland Fire Academy is always in March, and they run a line medic class. So
good
that
info.
Would be something to look into.
Excellent.
All right.
Well, again, we thank Physio Control for letting us be here and give you this great content here in the Medicast podcast booth. And to my sponsors, Jim and Joe, who are very busy at this conference, Paragon Medical Education, for what they do and for helping us sponsor my show, which is pushing into 2 years now, which we're very proud of. We enjoy that very much. And as we say in disaster medicine, why I'm Sam Bradley, I should mention what I do and where I come from. Sam Bradley 11 or Sam Bradley on social media, Twitter, Facebook, the usual places, and certainly on the disasterpodcast.com. Come and give us some comments and tell us what you think about our content and give us some idea of what you'd like to see us do. So as we say in disaster medicine, it is not everyday medicine.